Welcome. This is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute, and it's my pleasure to have with us today Michael Rossman, the general counsel for the Center for Individual Rights, who is notably the individual who litigated the last successful challenge at the Supreme Court level to a congressional statute under the Commerce Clause, United States v. Morrison. So we're very thrilled to have him here to discuss what's potentially a landmark challenge to a congressional statute, namely the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, sometimes popularly dubbed Obamacare. And we've been lucky enough to have Michael's participation in our featured discussion at our pointoflaw.com web magazine, in which we've had a number of top legal scholars and thinkers discussing this case concurrent with the oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much. And I just want to say every time someone introduces me as the person who last litigated the last successful Supreme Court challenge to a constitutional statute under the Commerce Clause, I want to mention that I would be happy to relinquish that title as soon as someone would be glad to take it from me.
This sounds good. Well, just first of all, I want to flesh out exactly what's at issue here in this case and how it differs from some of the two recent cases where the Supreme Court struck down on the statute under the Commerce Clause. I mean, once upon a time, the Supreme Court regularly would say, Congress, you're overstepping your bounds here under the Commerce Clause, up until, say, 1937, when the Supreme Court switched in composition, and then notably in the 1942 case, Wickard v. Filburn, suggested that under the Agricultural Adjustment Act, it was commerce for the interstate commerce for the purposes of congressional regulation when someone was growing his own wheat on his own farm for his own consumption, because it affected potentially market pricing in the broad national market. And since that time, there really have been two cases, not counting related cases that relate to the 10th Amendment, 11th Amendment, or what have you, that said under the Commerce Clause, Congress lacks this power. And that's Morrison, the case you worked on involving the Violence Against Women Act, and then a slightly earlier case, United States v. Lopez, which involved guns in schools. And both of those strike me as a little different than the case here concerning an individual mandate for health care insurance, as I see it. I mean, basically, the challenges rest on the fact that under the Commerce Clause, under the current doctrine, it's got to be related to the conduct being regulated has to be related to economic activity. And the primary objection, as I see it in Morrison and Lopez, was that the activity in question wasn't economic. Whereas here, as I read the briefs and listen to the questions, I see it as saying more, well, clearly this may be economic, but it's not really conduct or it's not really activity. Am I characterizing that correctly?
I think that's right. And another way of phrasing it is that they may be regulating something, but they're not regulating economic activity, as you say it. So it's either they're regulating inactivity or they're not regulating anything at all, or they're not regulating what they say they're regulating, like, for example, the healthcare market.
Right. I mean, that to me seems the other sort of core definitional question here. Is it to regulate? And you focused a lot on that in your first post on our weblog discussion. Following from that, the sort of question of market definition. In other words, the proponents of this law are saying, well, we're talking about the health care market. And then sort of the other challenge is, well, is it really the health insurance market or the health care market? So why can't we just say, well, everybody is going to use, this is what the proponents say, everybody's going to use health care at some point in their lives. So all we're doing is regulating the way you pay for health care. And you're basically just self-insuring if you decide not to buy health care insurance. So we're saying basically you can't self-insure. You're going to pay a penalty if you self-insure, in other words. Otherwise, you got to buy an actual health insurance product. That's really what the proponents say. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I mean, you identified two different arguments that they say. One is you cannot self-insure, which is basically the same thing as saying you can't just sit there and do nothing, in which case the question is it a regulation to force someone to purchase a product in a market? Is that a regulation? The other thing they say is, well, everybody, as you say, is going to buy health care at some point or another, and we're simply regulating how they're going to pay for it. The problem with that, of course, is that, well, it doesn't. It doesn't regulate how people pay for health care. You don't have to use your insurance in order to pay for health care. So in the context of the health care market, it's like asking whether subsidized student loans regulate the market for higher education services. Well, I mean, they certainly give people an incentive to use loans to pay for higher education services, but you can reasonably question whether that constitutes a regulation of the higher education services market. They certainly have given people a incentive to use their insurance to pay for health care, but they haven't said you have to, and they haven't otherwise regulated how you go about paying for health care. So arguably, and I think it's not a bad argument at all, the statute doesn't really regulate the market for health care in that way.
Well, let's say Congress had done something a little different. They just adjusted it a little different. And instead of saying, we're going to penalize you if you don't purchase health insurance, what if they said, well, if you purchase health care, as we're going to define it, and you don't have an insurance policy, then at the point of purchase, we're going to say you've got to pay a penalty of X dollars unless you're on a private health insurance plan or on a public health insurance plan. If you're just trying to purchase it without insurance, at the point of purchase, we're going to charge you a penalty. Could they do that?
I think it would be much more likely. My impression was that the proponents of the lawsuit, the challengers to the law, were essentially conceding that Congress could, in fact, require people to pay for health care with insurance, and right. Your proposed statute, hypothetical statute, would be something very similar to that, a penalty if you don't use insurance to
right.
pay for health care.
Whatever the mechanism is for enforcement, right? I mean,
right.
You could say. And similarly, what if they had done this through the taxing power? In other words, I mean, the argument's being made that it was, in fact, done with the taxing power. So I guess at the first threshold question, you know, what's wrong with that argument? In other words, some of the proponents of this law, and including the Obama administration, at least for the constitutional purposes, albeit not for statutory purposes under the Anti-Injunction Act, where they're saying it's not a tax. For constitutional purposes, they're saying it is a tax, and that, you know, the penalties collected under the Internal Revenue Code. What's wrong with that argument, first of all? And then second of all, couldn't Congress easily do this and pass constitutional muster, given the breadth of the income tax amendment as it's been interpreted, and just say, we're going to charge everyone a general tax levy and we're going to give refundable tax credits to everybody or non-refundable tax credits, some form of tax credit to everybody who actually proves to us they bought a health insurance policy? Couldn't they do that?
Well, let me answer the second question first. I think the answer is yes. Certainly Judge Kavanaugh, could they do it politically or could they do it constitutionally? Mm-hmm. Those are two different questions. They might have some problem doing it politically. I think they could do it constitutionally. And I take it that's what your question was.
Yes,
the,
of course.
To go back to the first question is what's wrong with the using that argument to describe the law that they actually did pass. I think there's two issues. One is there is a mandate, and then there is an increase in your taxes if you fail to comply with the mandate. And what the challengers were saying is these are two separate provisions, and we're challenging the obligation, the statement in law that we have to do something. And this, of course, raises a very interesting question as to whether or not a legal requirement that is not otherwise enforceable is a regulation, or whether you have to only think of it as part of the enforcement mechanism, or along with the enforcement mechanism that it uses in order to induce compliance with the mandate. The second problem with the argument is that Congress went to great lengths to say that it wasn't a tax, that it was rather a penalty, and the cases are not entirely clear as to how much weight should be given Congress's own recitation of what it is doing. And you know, obviously, I think, just judging from the oral argument, that Congress's own recitation that it was imposing a penalty and not a tax is probably going to carry the day. But again, it's just relying upon oral argument, which
and aren't
very
there,
imperfect predictor.
Aren't there even separate procedural rules? And I don't know that the Supreme Court would get into the weeds of Congress's own procedural rules, but in terms of how things actually get passed, if it's a tax or it's not a tax, that isn't there a different process that Congress actually goes through?
Yes, although that's not something I'm completely familiar with, right, so right. I probably shouldn't opine on it.
Sure. Well, let's go to another sort of clause of the Constitution that proponents of the law have invoked, and you in our final post in our discussion at Point of Law rejected, and that's the necessary and proper clause. Given the overarching scheme of economic regulation that the individual mandate's going to be complementing here, or is intended to complement here, the argument would be it's necessary and proper for the broad overall scheme. I mean, and the argument of the administration is, yeah, I mean, it's clearly necessary because the only way this can work, the system of mandates that people can get guaranteed issue, even if they have pre-existing conditions for insurance, et cetera, is if we force everyone into the system. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, let me first say, I'm not sure I rejected the suggestion that that was a good argument. I merely was trying to point out what the challengers were saying in opposition. I think they've raised some interesting points and some good points. Their argument is you can't create the problem, that is to say, in this instance, create the problem of insurance policies being sold at a very, very high price that many people will not want to purchase due to these community rating and other regulations which preclude insurance companies from rejecting applicants, essentially, because they're too sick, or from charging them a price which reflects the fact that they're sick. So there's these set of regulations, and what essentially Congress is saying, well, if we allow those regulations to go into effect without any kind of individual mandate, the insurance company is going to raise their prices very high, and nobody will be able to afford, or a lot of people would not be able to afford to buy the insurance policies. All we'll have is sick people buying insurance policies, and therefore we need to have a mandate. What the challengers have said is, well, you can't create the very problem that you deem an additional law is needed in order to make the whole thing work. If that were the case, you know, Congress could mandate the purchase of every product in the universe, because every product in the universe is probably regulated in one way or another by some federal regulation somewhere. And so what the Necessary and Proper Clause permits, according to the challengers, is you to remove an obstacle to enforcement of your regulation. So if your regulation requires insurance companies to sell to people who are sick, you can put in some criminal provision that would have a jail term for those who fail to do so. You can put civil fines in for those who, you know, refuse to sell to sick people. If you don't price in a fair community, in a community rating kind of way, you can be subject to civil fines. That's what this is what the challengers say. That's what the Necessary and Proper Clause permits you to do. It doesn't allow you to create a problem, namely that insurance policies will just be too darn expensive, and then create a solution to it by dragooning third parties who are not part of that market into the market. It's not a bad argument, because it appeals to the court's sense that there has to be a limit. And if we allow this kind of argument, if we allow the argument that Congress can create a problem and then pass additional legislation under the Necessary and Proper Clause as part of the overall comprehensive solution, then they can create any problem they want and then legislate in any fashion they want. And the notion of limited enumerated powers might fall.
Interesting. Well, now I want to step back from the challenge itself and sort of reach a threshold type of issue, which is sort of walking into the weeds of con law at the Supreme Court now. But it's something that one of your co-discussants at Point of Law brought up, Professor Jillian Metzger, and you responded to it. And that's the notion of a facial versus an as-applied challenge to a statute when you're challenging it on constitutional grounds. This is a facial challenge. In other words, it hasn't actually been applied to an individual who's suffered under it. There are different rules at play there. Can you just explain for us a little bit what this controversy is about and what Professor Metzger means and why you may not be persuaded by her position?
Well, the general rule, or the sometimes oft-cited rule from Salerno, is that in order to make a facial challenge, you have to show that there's no constitutional application of the statute. The same person who said that, Justice Scalia, also said that when we're dealing with Congress's enumerated powers, we use a different analysis. We start with the question of whether or not the statute is facially constitutional, and then and only then we go to the question of whether or not there should be an as-applied challenge. Now, if you look at the Commerce Clause area, and particularly to those statutes that Congress has deemed to be an exercise of their power to regulate things or activities that substantially affect commerce, you see that the court has basically only considered these issues on a facial, in a facial manner. And they said so. That's what they said in Raich when they sort of rejected an as-applied challenge. They said, well, Lopez and Morrison were facial challenges. And, of course, they were right. I've just written a law review article myself that describes what I think the proper analysis is, which is what the court is doing in those cases is essentially saying this is overbroad. You may have regulated some things that are economic activity. It's the case, in fact, that Alfonso Lopez, the defendant in United States versus Lopez, was actually carrying a gun for money. He was he was a courier. He was a gun courier who was being paid. So he was definitely engaged in economic activity. And it's definitely true that Congress could have, or we think Congress probably could have, regulated his activity with a different statute. The problem was the statute, the Gun-Free School Zones Act, that was involved with the United States versus Lopez, regulated a lot of other possessions of gun near school as well. And so the court, in my view, essentially was saying this statute is overbroad. It regulates a whole lot of non-economic activity, as well as perhaps some modest amounts of economic activity. And that's something Congress cannot do.
Interesting. Now, one final question before we wrap up, and that's sort of the question of so-called severability. And when you litigated Morrison, the court only overturned part of the Violence Against Women Act. Most of the lower courts to have considered this case have said, well, we're going to try to do a similar analysis. But the Supreme Court obviously briefed this, had oral arguments on it, and some of the justices seem to be throwing up their hands at the ability to sever out the individual mandate because it was so integrally related to the overall scheme Congress was going at here. What do you think of this severability question? And you know, is the court, if it finds this unconstitutional, are they likely to throw out the entire statute?
Well, there's sort of two interesting questions. One is, could this statute have passed without the individual mandate, or was it necessary in order for the statute to pass? And then the next question is, can the statute work in the absence of the individual mandate? I think the answer to the first question, as difficult as it is to answer either of these questions, the answer to the first question is probably no. I mean, each of these moving parts that they had in this statute was an integral part of getting somebody's vote. And it's likely that any part that got, if any part got pulled out, it seems likely they could have lost a few votes and been unable to pass the statute. Can it work without the individual mandate? It probably can. I mean, they might have to make a few tweaks here and there in order to protect the insurance companies from people who want to, you know, wait until they're sick in order to buy insurance. But some of those things are already there. The insurance companies, as I understand it, for example, can limit the periods of time in which people can purchase insurance, and that in and of itself could provide some protection. It would, I think, without the individual mandate, probably raise the cost of insurance policies to some substantial degree. Whether or not Congress would have preferred a statute without the individual mandate to nothing at all is sort of the question that the court has to ask, and it's an exceedingly difficult question involving all sorts of really counterfactual hypotheticals that I'm not going to make any prediction on.
Well, with that, we'll wrap this up, and I'll note just as an aside, and can it work with or without the individual mandate, without the individual mandate, Several of my colleagues at Manhattan Institute Center for Medical Progress would suggest that it can't work with the individual mandate, but that's a separate
policy question for
Congress to decide, not the courts. So, again, this is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. My pleasure to have with us today Michael Rossman, the general counsel of the Center for Individual Rights. You can get other podcasts and the full featured discussion on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act legal challenge at pointoflaw.com. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much.